Hi, my name's Tim Oldman. I'm the founder and CEO of the Leisman Index, the world's largest benchmarking and insight database on employee workplace experience. Since launching back in 2010, I've been fortunate enough to probe and debate the subject with some of the sector's best thought leaders, and these podcasts aim to package up some of those debates for you. So we're here with Duncan Young and Peggy Roth from my own team in Lendlease's space in London. Unusually, we normally see Duncan in Lendlease's space in sunny Barangaroo. I'm going to ask each to introduce themselves.
Good morning, Duncan Young. I'm the head of workplace health and wellbeing based in Sydney.
And I'm Peggy Roth, work as development director at Leisman. So I lead our work in the Nordics and in Australia, funnily enough, funny logistics. And then I also lead the research that we do on our massive database, workplace database.
Duncan, give us a sense of who you are, what you are, what's your thing?
Okay, so 24 years at Lendlease, end up being the head of health and wellbeing for Lendlease, focusing on workplace health and wellbeing, because as we know, the workplace is the number one place to fight lifestyle disease, and we need to start focusing on how to improve people's lives and help them thrive not only at work but in life as well.
It's the number one place to fight lifestyle disease. There's loads of other places, right, really, surely. That's a developer. That's Lendlease talking.
No, we spend a third of our lives at work, and the World Health Organization has identified the workplace as a priority setting or the number one place to fight lifestyle disease.
So what does that mean for you in terms of design of workplace?
Well, health and wellbeing is an overall journey of which the workplace and the place is one focus area. So we look at several focus areas. We look at healthy places. We look at healthy minds, healthy bodies, which is your physical health. And of course, healthy leadership. So we're social creatures and we take our cues from what other people do. So the place is very important, but not the only lever for change for workplace health.
You're probably not the only head of health and wellbeing, I know, but I could probably count those titles on a single hand globally. Give me an insight into why Lendlease needs its own head of health and wellbeing, and how many other professionals you're seeing cropping up with the similar title. And Peggy, you've also got a client in Scandinavia who's head of employee experience, so maybe we should just understand how the industry is moving to a more sort of people-centric approach to its workplace experience.
Yeah, I think as head of health and wellbeing, it's a relatively new title, and we're really focusing on holistically how people bring their best selves to work. And we can't just assume that's just what happens at work, but looking at a more broader approach to people in general, looking at healthy minds, healthy bodies, healthy places and healthy cultures, really important in the holistic side so people bring their best self to work. Because let's face it, healthy employees make healthy businesses. So it makes sense to look after your employees and hopefully they bring their best self to work.
Yeah, I mean, the employee experience in the workplace, it's impacted by so many different things. And it's actually, we've gone from having real estate executives to workplace, which already should be encompassing not only the physical environment, but also the virtual and the social. And I think turning that around and actually looking at it from an employee experience perspective, having someone who's there really to look after the employees and their experience, whether it is from a physical workplace perspective or the virtual or the social perspective, it's really important. I hope that's a way we're going towards.
The role of head of health and wellbeing seems to fit neatly between health and safety, which is a manager of chronic health and safety conditions, things that happen that are quite big. And of course, HR, who are there to attract and retain the best people. So I think there's this small niche that's happening in the wellness space that sits between, you know, HR and health and safety.
Yeah, I think in fairness to you, though, that what you add to that role here at Lendlease is a deep understanding and a passion for the quality of the built environment. And I guess then what you're connecting is the individual health and well-being of an employee with an understanding that the infrastructure of work, be that the virtual infrastructures of technology or the physical infrastructure of the design of physical space, are impacting on that employee. And I wonder how many people from HR can come across and make that jump into an understanding of this physical corporate real estate facilities management. Equally, I wonder how many facility managers could potentially move into that area, or how many real estate traditionals could soften a little bit in terms of their understanding of human dynamics.
I think what's a little bit different about me, this is a hobby that's got out of control. So I've taken a personal interest in not only my own health, but the health of others. And it's amazing that I can apply that to the workplace to actually help other employees with my own knowledge and help them bring their best selves to work. So I'm in a really fortunate position.
Right. So it's not quite the crack of dawn because my commute was very different this morning to normal and very different to your commute. But talk to us about that. The power of the sort of recharge times. We talked a little bit about this yesterday at a conference. We were both at the decompression and or compression zone of the travel to or the travel away from the workplace. To what extent does that impact on your working day, do you think?
Yeah, so my morning, I'm obviously in a different time zone to my actual body clock at the moment. Being based in Sydney, I'm here in London. But we appreciate that how you start your day is very important for your overall sleep patterns and your restoration. So I always try and start the day by getting a bit of natural sunlight. So I walked into work this morning from King's Cross all the way to Regent's Place. We know that if you can get 10 to 15 minutes of sunlight on your body first thing in the morning, then it's likely to help you reset your circadian rhythm, which again helps you during the day and centers you on the right time zone. Energy, as Tim referred to, is really important. So we've got a program called Manage Your Energy Renewal. And we know that time is finite, but energy is not. And so there are many things you can do during the day to increase your overall energy. Obviously, the number one thing is getting a good night's sleep, but what you eat, the movement you do during the day, and also who you connect with is also important for your overall restoration and getting energy back to make sure that whatever recovery time you do have is effective recovery time.
We've covered this in one of our issues of the Leisman Review, prompted by yourself, but just to put this out of the workplace or out of the corporate office environment scenario for a second, just tell us a little bit about the Israeli parole court hearing research, which is often in your presentations.
Yeah, it's an oldie but a goodie, but there's a book called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, and he talks about the ability of people to make decisions effectively throughout the day. So in summary, the Israeli parole judges are reviewed over a 10-month period to see how they made their decisions. And as it turns out, what you eat and when you have a break really does determine your ability to make decisions. So in the case of the Israeli parole judges, they start off the day fresh and full of food. Clemency is about 65%. And as the day wears on, that tends to drop. But every time the judges take a small break, get some food, and which is really about getting glucose back in your body, clemency actually returns. There seems to be a lot of discussion these days about making your best decisions in the morning, and that's when you've got your best willpower and also your best decision-making capability. So it's important to remember periodization and getting the right food to help you make decisions during the day, because as knowledge workers, we're all expected to make great decisions every time.
So these restorative segments then we've been talking about, it's not just outside of work once you get home, the quality of sleep, we might come onto that in a bit more detail in a second, but restorative space inside the office, in your own offices, the Lendly spaces, those restorative spots are prolific. I guess what we're looking for then is some degree of measurement or science that means that we could actually demonstrate back to a prospective occupier of a space why they should do it on themselves. Because what I'm trying to say is that, you know, actually as Lendlease, you're in a slightly luxurious position. Because it's your space and your advert for your own skills. The capability of occupiers to do that in spaces that you're designed for them are slightly less easy.
Yeah, so that is an interesting point. We do agree that we have the opportunity to showcase what best practice looks like. But I think the majority of people now understand what good workplaces look like. We're talking about places that have great access to natural daylight, the right 100% fresh air, the right lighting, et cetera, but we've got to increasingly look at what social connection means and what social connection means for people within business. We're going to see a wave of social isolation into the future, aka loneliness, and I think the workplace is going to be really important to ensure that we have better social communication, because we learn through not only observation but also connecting with others. And let's remember, we're a knowledge-based economy. So getting people to bump into each other and sharing ideas is really important. So I do agree we are in a quite a luxurious position, but you can still design in elements to encourage social collision and connection in any workplaces, and they really don't need to be expensive.
I guess probably if you're a CFO cynically looking at a space plan, they're probably the hardest things to defend. if you're a designer or you're a workplace manager. So maybe there's some stuff we can do on that and actually just look at some of the satisfaction and importance attached to those restorative spaces.
Mm.
It would be really intriguing if we actually found that those spaces that fail to deliver are lacking certain social infrastructure elements.
Well, I think these social areas for restoration are harder to measure, but that doesn't mean they're not important. And we know from Bupa, who the big health provider, that if you take lunch away from your desk, that you have a heart age 1 year younger than those that eat lunch at their desk. And I think that's because when you eat lunch at your desk, you're still working away. You're not thinking about what you're eating. You're not stopping when you're full because you haven't acknowledged anything. So they don't need to be big commitments. It's just making sure you're away from your desk.
But how do you actually change that behavior? I mean, it's one thing, for example, to design in the restorative places and spaces in the office, but how do you actually get people to utilize them and to take those breaks?
Yeah, so I think we need to come back to the concept of social norming, that we need to educate people to say, this is a good idea, move away from your desk, take some time out to restore during the day. So we talk about the impacts of decision making for people that don't take breaks. And then we need to show it as a leadership culture. So the people who are influential, and that doesn't actually isn't in order of rank in your position in the company, like many of us are influential and yet we're not super senior in the business. So getting those people who articulate what they're doing. So sorry, I'm late. I took a quick break. You know, I decided to take lunch away from my desk, something like that. Getting a dialogue about why it's important is really, really critical to moving the needle forward.
So we think about the World Building Standard. It's great that through a framework or a checklist approach to the wellness of corporate workplace, more and more people are having these types of dialogues. I wonder whether it will go in a similar trajectory to BRIAM or LEED, where actually initially there is a resistance and a lack of appetite to debate, and almost a sort of how dare you tell us how to design a building type pushback. But actually what happens in the long run is it becomes almost like the norm.
Yeah.
That to design a building today without LEED or BRIAM certification would be seen as strange. So are we just on a long path, do you think, around wellness? And could it be shorter than the one that we had to go through on the higher quality environmental design of structures?
Yeah, there's no doubt that when we start any new movement that there are leaders and pioneers in the space, and we've got to applaud Wells for bringing their framework to the table. We're a big supporter of Wells and we're looking to roll it out in many of our developments and fit outs. I think these frameworks are very useful for bringing everyone up to speed, but let's remember that it's not just about the building. That's really good health is moves beyond the building. It's more about a business-wide approach. And also, people don't spend all of their lives at work, so we've got to help people, if they're open to it, live healthier lives outside of work as well.
We were recently lab rats in one of your ongoing crazy Australian experiments with heart rate variability monitors. Tell us a little bit more about what you've been doing with these clinical quality devices.
So they're called a heart rate variability monitor, and they're used in elite sports to determine when an athlete has had sufficient recovery before they go back out and train again. So we've taken that technology and we put it on the corporate athletes, such as yourself, Tim and Peggy. And really it's about understanding whether people are getting enough recovery during their day. The really telling insight that we get is that even though people self-report a sleep duration of, say, 8 hours, which is ideal because, as everyone knows, you need between 7 and 9 hours sleep per night, often forgotten but really important. But it shows the level of effective sleep, so how much recovery you actually get during that sleep time. Now, we've got a bit over 600 participants from China, Singapore, Australia and the UK as well. And it's interesting to note, with more than 1,200 days of data, that no matter where you live around the world, sleep and restoration continues to be an issue. And we'll see it more in the media in terms of the books coming out, Thrive, Sleep, lots of talk about renewing of energy to live a long and full life. And obviously that takes us into Linda Grattan's work, The 100-Year Life. So we're going to be living long and full lives, and we're going to have to be healthy in order to keep on working. So it's really important that we understand a bit more about the science of how we sleep. And the really funny thing about the program is it gives people a status. It's one thing to give people awareness, but when you give them their actual statistics, it becomes very sticky and they get great buy-in. And I'll have a lot of conversations about sleep. I'm very interested in your sleep, Tim. But it's interesting when you compare it to 600 odd other people, but just talking about that sleep amongst ourselves is really important as well. So Peggy, if you've had a bad night's sleep and you've just got off another intercontinental flight, then it's really important that you don't make those really big decisions when you've got a bit of jet lag first thing in the morning.
Take note, yeah. Peggy, you wore it in a sort of an extension to the experiment that we did. So you crossed the time zone, you crossed to the opposite side of the planet. Duncan wouldn't reveal anything from the findings from that, but what did it do for you in terms of, as Duncan said, sort of just raising awareness?
Oh, you know that sleep is important, but you don't really know until you really see it. So it totally opened my eyes to really trying to get enough sleep. I went out and bought myself a Fitbit afterwards, and I track it all the time now. It increases my stress levels when I see that I haven't slept enough. Consuming alcohol, for example, the impact that it had on your sleep, because basically the conclusion was I sleep really well. I have a talent in sleeping, apart from when I then consume alcohol.
Well,
yeah, no, yeah. but then alcohol had a massive impact on my sleep, which it probably does for most people.
And that's quite a common outcome. So some people are self-identified as what we call super sleepers. So they rate themselves as serious people who can do some rack time. But virtually everyone is surprised about even a small amount of alcohol. Notwithstanding, it helps you get to sleep, actually doesn't promote overall recovery. Less common but equally as important is the effect of technology on your sleep patterns. So we talk a lot about the blue light and phones. We're consuming, they say, 63,000 words a day in content. So we're just overloaded. We're always on. So finding that little bit of time to restore, to make sure that our sleep patterns are great, is really important. We also see some quite funny examples of people have their own individual tricks for great recovery. My favourites are people who either ride their push bike or ride their motorbike home seem to have a good break between work and home life. And when I ask the question, what happened during this period and why are you able to engage with this parasympathetic nervous activity, they say, when I ride a bike, I have to focus so hard on staying upright that I forget about work. So I think we can all learn a little bit about leaving work and developing a technique, whether that be mindfulness, riding your bike, or just getting some light exercise after work to actually really help form the break between work life and home life, so the work-life transition.
Right, straying into an area that I know you're both particularly opinionated and passionate about, the de-demonising of open plan workplace. Duncan, both of your spaces that I know well, here in Regent's Place and Brangher in Sydney, fully open plan, right, from the most senior down to the most junior member of staff. Hey, you've just done some research across our data on the de-demonising of open plan space. Do you want to give us a little insight into that? And then maybe, Duncan, you can comment on the Lendlease approach to your own open plan environments.
Yeah, so the interesting thing is if you Google open plan, probably the 21st things that you'll get is 10 ways to survive the open plan, or things like the open plan was devised by Satan in the deepest caverns of hell, and it's all about how bad the open plan is. And basically that's what everyone would find, whether it is someone deciding on a new workplace project or then the employee who's about to move into an open environment. Everything we read is about how bad open plan is. And quite often you will find that those articles might actually refer to some research that with maybe a few hundred, even 1,000 or so employees who have said that their open plan is not good. They can't work well there. The challenge there is, though, an open plan, it is a fact. It can be really rubbish. It can be really bad if it is a poorly designed open plan. But when we then look at our database of over 2,000 workplaces, and we look at the proportion of people in an open environment and enclosed, we actually find that while, yes, there are some really poor open plan environments in our database, actually 9 out of 10, top 10 workplaces or high-performing workplaces in the database are extensively or mainly open plan. So most people are working in some sort of open environment. So basically, it's showing that an open plan, it can be really good, it can be really bad if it's poorly designed. And the same basically applies for more enclosed offices as well. They can be really good and they can be really bad. But just the general perception still and the message that is put out there is that open plan is the worst faith that you could go towards.
If we take your accusation of lazy journalism, then is it that actually, if we think about the average activity within a Lendlease environment, it's buzzing here this morning already outside. There may be some background noise on the recording from just people buzzily going around their activities already. Construction is a creative activity. Designing buildings is a creative, energized, sort of clear line of sight to output type, interactive, highly collaborative business to be in. Think about those journalists having to write the articles, in fairness, are at the sort of often at the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of highly concentrative, individually focused, research-based, desk-based activities. So I just wonder out of fairness whether it's actually that some journalists are being played with in open plan, whereas for an occupier like Lendlease, the only solution to that interaction is great open plan space.
We actually did some research before we opened Barangaroo, and we determined that 53% of our work is actually done in teams. So we're moved, I suppose, beyond the concept of open plan, and we call it agile, or we actually call it team-based working. So we actually work in teams. And let's face it, if you don't get the basics of a building right, doesn't matter whether it's open plan or agile. So you need your thermal comfort right. You need the noise levels right. You need all the normal things, the access to sunlight, et cetera, et cetera. And then if you're providing a variety of settings that where people can do their best work, so in our case, working in a team environment, collaborative type team, visualize a long kitchen table. But if you need to do focus work, you actually move just slightly away. You do some focus work in areas that are heavily steeped in biophilia. So we've got a lot of plants. Plants are great for absorbing noise, by the way, and give you a good well-being effect. So just having that variety of settings and giving people permission to use them. So we move regularly throughout the day through these different settings. And what we're finding is that people can move into absolutely soundproof rooms. We've got podcast recording rooms right through to what we call the pods, which are a room that's quite noise insulated versus focus areas versus open tables. So having the ability to, when you're in the open plan, for people to visually connect with you is really important. So we anecdotally see that we're doing less meetings because people are bumping into each other, having a quick conversation. That stops a full meeting having to be convened. So that connecting and having that quick conversation is making all the difference.
Peggy, then, just on that point that I started on, are there professions, do you think, or organisational types where, in fairness, open plan possibly isn't the best solution or is a slightly compromised solution over even the best designed open plan space?
I think if you look at someone's role and what you do, most of us would still have some sort of variety, whether it is only between a few activities or 20 different activities that you do. And it's just the fact that in knowledge work, the process of creating new knowledge, you'll have phases when you need to interact with others, you need to reflect on things, discuss things with your colleagues. So even in the example of journalists, even if they're writing articles on their own, I think there's a lot of benefit in, if I was a journalist, to actually reflect on things and bounce ideas around with your colleagues. So even though the actual final putting the article on paper is individual, I'm sure there are phases before that where you do need to interact. Yeah.
So it's interesting just to think about how good ideas develop. And I'm just going to read you the title of this academic research. It's called Proximity Effect on the Dynamics and Outcomes of Scientific Collaboration. And this essentially looks at the effect of scientists' ability to come up with new hybrid ideas by tracking how many of them bump into each other. So they leave their enclosed office and the amount of crossover between lunchrooms, staircases and walking paths, those that have a high amount of bump factor then go on to have far more collaborations and come up with innovative ideas. So it looks like these scientists might actually work in essentially a soundproof box or what we used to call an office. And then when they walk and connect with others, then they come up with these ideas. So a bit like how we're designing workplaces today, we've got to make sure that we're designing the right space for the right people, but the social collision and the social areas for people to connect are really important, both in science and also in everyday sharing of ideas in the everyday knowledge economy.
No, you're right. There's a project we've case studied quite extensively, and perhaps we'll do a podcast on shortly, with Boston Consulting Group's new office in Manhattan at 10 Hudson Yards. And they talk a lot about the collision coefficient, but actually trying to measure how often colleagues cross paths is key in understanding whether that infrastructure is working. From a master planning perspective, the layout of the space can create those collision points.
Yep, great.
Which is great in a new space. I guess the negative in an older space is that those points can also be infection points, right? If you've got a disengaged employee, crossing paths with a semi-disengaged employee, it's not always amazing creative interactions that are happening at those collision points. It actually equally can be in a negative environment, can be that you've got a sort of toxic effect of negative vibes being exchanged at those crossovers.
Yeah, well, I think we've got a plan for the positive. You know, I like Barbara Fredrickson's theory of positivity. It's a spiral of positivity. So she talks about small increasing. So frequency is more important than intensity. So these small elements of bumping into each other, positive interactions increase positively overall outside of just doing one big event where you're hoping everyone will be engaged. So it can be both positive and negative, but we've got to look on the positive side that people want to have a positive mindset overall and contribute, and we're hoping that's the same in workplaces.
I think after that conversation around the importance of creating those collision points and collaboration, it's still always important to remind ourselves the importance of the individual work and the individual focus. So I think there's been a bit of a trend of workplaces really emphasizing creating these collaboration points, and then sometimes to the point where the individual or supporting the individual work has actually suffered. And as our research shows, a big impact on whether you can work productively or not is actually on the individual things that you do. So it seems to have a bigger impact on whether you can feel that your workplace enables you to work productively or not if those individual tasks are supported. So basically it's a balance. You need to be able to support both.
Yeah, it's interesting in our research of the heart rate variability monitors and tracking when people restore their energy. And let's not forget that not all stress is bad. We need a certain amount of stress in our life, but keep it under 50% of your day. When we look at people who work from home occasionally, so that's twice a month or once a week type thing, we see high levels of restoration when they're actually working at home in their own space. Now, I don't know whether that's because you get to wear your own stuff, so your tracksuits and your UGG boots, or whether they're actually working on something that has purpose or they're working in a space they're comfortable. We also see it at work that people can restore during a busy working day, but it's less frequent. So it's quite interesting that there are these small pockets, and we've got to find out what these pockets are. I know for sure that, you know, walking meetings and also having meetings outdoors seem to promote restoration even while you're working. Generally, things where you're connecting with people that you want to connect with seems to show
that. So this is something we should explore further. Maybe we should do this when I'm next back down in Sydney. But there's some previous work that I did a long time ago, pre-Leisman, which looked at the visual landscape that you have within your peripheral vision and your frontal vision at the place of work, and goes back to some of the sort of primeval instincts of when things are going on behind you, there is a fight or flight type instinct that we just naturally have wired into us. In a massive open landscape, or even in a private office, when you can hear things happening, so even while we're doing this recording, we can hear people walking past the corner office that we're in. I wonder to what extent when people are working at home then, actually they're in their cave, right? They're in control. They're the gatekeeper of the castle. So yes, the landscape in which they are placing themselves for whatever work they're doing corporately,
yep,
is more in their control than anywhere else in a yes, choice of landscape. And I think maybe that's something that we should just try and think about and investigate.
So. Yeah, we can look further at that. And I just want to correct Tim. We're not in a corner office. We're actually in a corner meeting room. So even Tim slips up from time to time, wishing he had a corner office.
Clearly, Duncan, just a lack of sleep.
Lack of sleep. Yeah, well, I think where you sit and your visual landscape, we also see a lot of stuff going on with eye strain. So the ability to look up every 20 minutes, look 20 feet for 20 seconds really does help with your eye muscles. And of course, we're spending so much time on screens these days, really long hours during the day. We're clocking up on screens. It's affecting our vision overall. And obviously where you sit and observing your environment has a big impact to your overall feeling of trust and vulnerability.
I wanted to come back to a point much earlier on. You said, Duncan, that we need to get the basics right in order to create a good environment. You start off with the basics. And one of the things you mentioned was noise levels. Yes. Now, across our database, only 30.5% of the respondents are actually satisfied with noise levels. Kind of feels like it's not actually a basic almost when it's not right.
Yeah.
What do we do about it? How can we fix it?
Well, look, I think acoustics in any building's a big issue, and you can get some relief by making sure you've got acoustic materials. What you're walking on is important, and obviously some acoustic materials in the wall. You can use artificial techniques like white noise. So with chill beams these days that don't make a lot of actual noise in the background, you add some white noise, or increasingly we're talking about pink noise. Lots of people like Julian Treasure talk about noise in the environment and adding extra stuff in, but I don't think we'll ever solve it. I don't also think that a perfectly quiet environment is perfect either. You want to basically hear the buzz of the office, and it's quite contagious when you hear everyone's excited. But you want to be able to go into a place where you can do your own private and focused work, and that own place could be with some headsets on, or it could be a enclosed room that gives you that acoustic separation and privacy you're after. But I think it's something we've all got to work on, get the acoustics right in offices.
Okay, one last thing just to pick up on there in terms of finding that privacy. More and more we see people as you walk around open plan offices with the, you know, the Bose noise cancelling headsets in, and they're plugged into the iPhone listening to the music. In your presentation yesterday that I sat through, there was an element talking about the restorative values of music.
Yes.
And singing. Can you just give us that little bit, that little clip in terms of what that adds? And then I'm wondering whether we should be promoting or accepting that actually putting the earphones in an open plan office is not negative. It's not something that people should be outlawing. Actually, potentially it has health and concentrated benefits for those employees.
Yeah, so the session Tim was referring to yesterday is called Manage Your Energy Renewal. And we're looking at ways for people to increase their recovery during the day. So we recover at night, but also during the day we have places to recover. And one of them is about either connecting with loved ones or people you really like. So Tom Rath's best friend at work type stuff is really important. 7 times more engagement from people that have best friend at work. But the singing thing is really interesting. So you can put on the headsets and listen to your favorite song, and that's going to show an improvement in your positive well-being or your parasympathetic nervous system. We see people who sing in choirs exhibit a lot of parasympathetic nervous system because they get into a diaphragmatic breathing rhythm. And of course, singing your favorite song, obviously you can't do that in the office, but you can definitely do it in the car with the windows up, or just humming along to your favorite thing. So again, back to Barbara Fredrickson's point, it's actually about small positive things during the day. It gives you greater life satisfaction overall. I'm a big fan of wearing headphones, especially in the times, if you think about periodization, when you're more on and more efficient, and sometimes you're less efficient, like in the afternoon, I like to pop on my headsets. It definitely helps me get through the post-lunch slump and listening to my favourite tunes. I actually listen to quite a few of the songs over and over because they make me reflect on fond times in the past and help me get through the work that I'm focusing on at the time. So put on your headset. Don't worry what other people are thinking. Please don't sing in the office or even tap your leg too loud. But I think these small elements of restoration during the day is important.
So perhaps karaoke room in the office karaoke is the next new thing.
No
big
way.
Thing.
kick out the nap rooms and put in
kick
the karaoke
out
room.
The nap rooms.
Duncan, you mentioned a lot of other people in the context of your research and your reading. One book or one podcast or one TED Talk that our listeners should go away from this and read, what would be your favourite? What would be your first recommendation?
I'm going to say two. I'm going to say Simon Sinek, who talks about asking the right questions. So the podcast called Why, also the book of the same title, and Linda Grattan's work, The 100-Year Life. Really fascinating stuff on how we're going to live longer. Longevity is no longer based on your genetics. It's based on your lifestyle and what tools we'll need in the future to live long, happy and prosperous lives. And that also leads into the blue zones, the looking at those 5 zones around the world where people live regularly into their 90s or healthily into their 90s and often over 100. So again, those three are worth looking at: Blue Zones, 100-Year Life, and Simon Sinek's Why.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, both of you. Duncan, thanks very much indeed. If anybody wants to connect with you, they should come through us and we'll make those introductions. But thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Well, look, I hope that's got you thinking. And if you have a suggestion for a subject you'd like me to probe or someone you think I should be talking to, please feel free to let me know. You can, of course, connect with me or anyone of the Leisman team via any of the usual channels. And to stay up to date with our thinking, just head to leismanindex.com. Thanks for listening.